Chapter 9. It was not until several days after they left Phillip's Island that Stephen had a quiet evening in the cabin to spread his hurried notes and some of his botanical specimens and begin a detailed account of his journey up the Sinon River. He had, of course, told Jack of the pygmy hippopotamus, the red bush pig, the froward elephant that chased him into a baobab tree, the bay-thighed monkeys, the chimpanzees, mild, curious, though timid, a terrestrial orchid higher than himself with rose-pink flowers, the crew python that Square addressed in a respectful chant and that watched them turning its head as they paced meekly by, the seven different hornbills, the two pangolins, the large variety of beetles, of course, and a scorpion 7.5 inches long, together with sunbirds and weavers.
"And your Potto?" asked Jack. "I hope you saw your Potto."
"I saw him, sure," said Stephen, "clear on a long bare branch, tilted to the moon, and he gazed down with his great round eyes. I dare say he advanced a foot or even 18 inches while I watched him."
"Did you shoot him?"
"I did not. I'm not naturalist enough, nor would you have done so, but I did shoot a fishing vulture that I prize, and if it prove a nondescript, as I trust it will, I shall name it after the ship."
Those early days on the island and the opposite shore had been full of activity. There was some malarial fever already among those who had raided Sherborough, and although the captured slavers, they had sailed confidently into the harbour without the least precaution, had no more than half a cargo each, many of the negroes had been aboard since Old Calabar, and some were in a bad way. Now, however, the two Dutchmen and the Dane had been sent off with prize crews to Freetown, and the two deckers, together with the slow, heavy-sailing Thames and the Aurora, had weighed by night, standing out to sea, well out beyond even the highest tree's horizon, to head eastward to the Bight of Benin, thus setting the Commodore's plan in motion. In the morning, those on the Bellona's quarterdeck could make out the Laurel's humble topsails on the larboard beam, and the Laurel was in touch with the inshore brigs. All was in train. The ship settled back into ordinary daily life, and Stephen was able to arrange his specimens in some sort of order, skin his birds, and label everything before sheer quantity. It had been a rich expedition, overwhelmed fallible memory. In all this he had John Square's informed and valuable help, but when, after dinner, he sat down to the task of writing an exact account, he was alone. Usually, once he had sunk into the proper mood and had marshalled all his facts, he wrote quite fast. But now, although the picture of that blessed river, the clear strand between the water and the forest, and a fishing vulture overhead was exactly present in his mind, names, time of day, and the sequence of events were less clear by far, and they would not easily yield to what mental effort he could bring to bear. Languor, muscular pain, incipient headache, stupidity. He had drunk a couple of glasses of wine at dinner and a cup of coffee after, and on the supposition that this one cup had not been enough to counteract the meal, he went into the great cabin where Jack Aubrey was busy at his desk, a pot beside him. Two more cups did produce a laboured paragraph or two, but this was nothing like the happy, spontaneous flow that had been running through his head the day before. A modest ball of coca leaves. He was husbanding his store, scarcely helped his prose, but after a while it did prompt him to go to his looking-glass and put out his tongue. Alas, it was scarlet, as he had half suspected, and his eyes, though bright, had a ferrety look round the edges, while his lips might have been rouged. He felt his pulse, quick and full. He took his bodily temperature with Fahrenheit's thermometer, a little above 100, scarcely more than the surrounding air. He reflected for a while and then went below, where he found Mr. Smith rolling pills in the dispensary.
"Mr. Smith," he said, "in Bridgetown I make no doubt you saw many cases of the yellow fever."
"Oh, yes, sir," said Smith. "It was our chief killer. The young officers looked to it for promotion. They called it the Black Vomit, or sometimes Yellow Jack."
"Would you say that there was a facies febris markedly typical of the disease?"
"Yes, indeed, sir, more so than in almost any other."
"Then be so good as to come with me when you have finished that board of pills, till I bring you to a good light."
No light could have been better than the open gun port by which they stood, nor could any young medical man have been more convincing than Mr. Smith. After he had looked at Stephen with the closest, most objective attention, he quite naturally assumed the physician's liberty, raising his eyelids, desiring him to open his mouth, taking his carotid pulse, and asking the relevant personal questions. At length, looking very grave, he said,
With all the reserves due to my fallibility and relative inexperience, sir, I should say that with one exception, you have all the characteristics of a patient in the first stadium of the yellow fever. But I pray I may be mistaken.
Thank you for your candour, Mr. Smith. What is the exception?
The visible anxiety and the strongly felt oppression about the precordia, which has never been absent in any of the cases I have seen, and which, in Barbados, is held to be most significant.
Perhaps you have never examined a patient fortified by coca, that stoical plant, said Stephen inwardly, and aloud,
In spite of that absence, Mr. Smith, we will treat the indisposition as a case of nascent yellow fever, and I shall dose myself accordingly. Have we any Columba root left?
I doubt it, sir.
Then the Radix serpentariae virginiani will answer very well. I shall also take a large quantity of bark, and should the disease declare itself, Mr. Smith, I formally direct that there shall be no bleeding in this case, and no purging whatsoever. There is no plethora. As much warm water, just tinged with coffee, may be exhibited, as much as possible, without gross discomfort. And sponging, mere sponging, no foolish effusion, would be beneficial at the height of the feverish stadium. Do you undertake to follow my direction, William Smith?
Yes, sir.
He was about to add something, but thought better of it. Otherwise, a dim light, with what quiet a man of war at sea can provide, and my pouch of coca leaves beside me, is all I wish. In spite of the estimable Dr. Lind and several others, I do not believe the yellow fever to be infectious. But rather than distress my shipmates, I shall live in my cabin on the orlop for the time being. The little booth is in moderately good order, but I shall be obliged if you would have it swept to some extent. Not swabbed and flogged more or less dry, but swept. For the great shining brown West African cockroach, though interesting as an individual, grows tiresome in large numbers, and I fear they are already breeding with us.
Very well, sir. I shall come back as soon as the cabin is ready and aired.
Left to himself, Stephen made his slow way to the empty wardroom and sat there beside the rudder head, gazing astern, for though this deck was denied a stern gallery, it did possess a noble breadth of windows directly overhanging the white turmoil of the Bellona's wake. Nothing more hypnotic, and for a while his mind sank into a familiar, dreamy vagueness before returning to distinct, sequential thought. The Yellow Jack was indeed a killer. It was difficult to fix upon any satisfactory figure, though he had heard well-authenticated accounts of a mortality amounting to 80 in 100. As for material affairs, he had made what Mr. Lawrence described as a cast-iron will before leaving England, with some very solid gentlemen as trustees to look after Diana, Bridget, Clarissa, and the others. While as for the less tangible side, his experience as a physician had shown him that all other things being equal, patients who give in, either from terror or pain or a want of spirit, want of appetite for life, did not survive, whereas those with an urgent desire to live without the loss of so much as an hour, those with an enchanting daughter, an ample fortune, a collection of almost certainly unknown phanerogams.
"What is it?" he cried.
"Commodore's compliments, sir," said a red-haired youngster, so young that he was still shedding teeth, "and would be happy to see the doctor at his leisure."
"My duty to the Commodore," replied Stephen mechanically, "and shall wait upon him directly."
He sat on for a few minutes, and then stood up, dusted himself, straightened his wig and neckcloth, and slowly climbed the ladder to the quarter-deck, and so aft, his knees feeling strangely weak.
"There you are, Stephen," cried Jack, while Tom Pullings leapt to his feet and set him a chair. "How good of you to come so soon! Tom and I wanted you to look over this statement of our proceedings since arriving on the station. Perhaps you could throw in some elegant turns of phrase. Mr. Adams writes a capital hand, but he is no better than we are, at your elegant turn of phrase."
"It is only a rough draft, Doctor," said Tom.
Stephen read for a while.
"What do you mean by expediently?" he asked. "Proceeded as expediently as possible."
"Why, as fast as ever we could sail," said one,
and...
"Like expedition, you know," said the other, "with the greatest expedition."
"If you do not like as fast as ever we could sail," began Stephen.
"No," said Tom, "as fast as ever we could sail is low."
"Then put with the utmost celerity," said Stephen.
"Celerity, there's a word for you," said Tom, smiling.
"How do you spell it, sir?"
A pause.
"How do you... Are you feeling quite well, sir?"
Startled, they both looked at him with great concern as he sat there, gasping. Jack pulled the bell line, and to the answering Grimble, he said,
"Pass the word for the surgeons, mate. Tell Killick to ready cot, nightshirt, chamber pot."
Both assistant surgeons reported within the minute, Killick only seconds later, and in the ensuing contention the faint Stephen, weak in body and will, was overwhelmed by kindly insistence.
"Infection be damned," said the Commodore. "I had a touch of the yellow jack in Jamaica when I was a boy. I was salted. Besides, it ain't infectious."
"Doctor, you do look wholly pale," said Tom Pullings. "Fresh air is what you need, not the stink of bilge in the orlop."
He was overwhelmed, and after a certain amount of activity and carefully moderated noise, he found himself in his familiar cot, under the shaded poop skylight with a jug of lukewarm water tinted with coffee in reach, and his coca leaves. His fever was mounting, his pulse was firm and rapid, his breathing fast. A grateful waft of sea air passed over his face. He settled himself to the coming trial. The first stadium. The opening day of the disease, the kindest, sees much dozing, though in spite of the moderately elevated animal heat, the sensation of chill returns. At this time the tongue is moist, rough, the skin moist, with an often profuse sweating.
"Pray, Mr. Smith, give me a brief account of the three stadia of this malady and their separate events, and it would be as well if Mr. Macaulay were to listen and to observe the symptoms as you name them," said Stephen.
"Well, sir, this is the second day of the first stadium, and we may expect a diminution of the animal heat, increasing restlessness and jactitation. We shall find the urine cloudy, troubled, probably bloody, dark in any event, and although the muscular pains and heavy sweats of yesterday diminish, the patient grows increasingly despondent."
"It is very well, very valuable, that the patient should be told this. For, gentlemen, you are to consider that if he knows his sadness to be, as who should say, mechanical, a mere part of the disease, common to all sufferers from it, and not the reasoned outcome of the working of his own mind, still less the onset of melancholia, or even the result of guilt, he is very much better armed against its attack."
"Yes, sir," said Smith. "Pray show me your tongue."
"Exactly so. This is the second day and the middle is brown. Should you like me to hold your shaving glass, sir?" "If you please."
"Tomorrow the roughness and ill colour will abate, but I regret to say that tomorrow, the third day of the first stadium, will also see heavy vomiting and great weakness."
"The weakness is already strongly marked. Pray set the wine glass to my lips. I can scarcely raise it, much less keep it steady."
A party of seamen employed in setting up the foretopmast shrouds, loosened by the onset of the dry season, saw their midshipman reach out for a backstay and slide down on deck, presumably to go to the head. They relaxed, and one of the simpler hands, returning still again to the gossip of the ship, said,
"So the doctor would not let us go ashore for fear of the fever, and it's him as got the yellow jack. Oh, ha, ha, ha! He wouldn't let us go, and now he's got it himself, God love us."
"You better not tell that to Barrett Bondon," said another, "or he'll serve you out like he served Dick Rowe, as he's laughing the other side of his face now, what face he has left."
The second stadium. Pulse weak and declining, but no fever. Indeed, the bodily heat is less than the ordinary degree of warmth. Extreme restlessness and yellow profusion of the eyes and person. Black vomit. Still greater despondency, prostration, delirium. This stadium lasts an indeterminate number of days before either ceasing entirely or merging with the third. It was through this prostration and this delirium, a moderate delirium apparently checked by the coca leaves and nearer to a waking dream than to the raving of high fever, that Stephen was continuously aware of Jack, a comforting presence, moving quietly about the room, talking now and then in a low voice, giving him a drink, holding him up to be sick, and that in one of his many lucid intervals he heard a hand on the poop say,
"Don't you breathe anywhere near the skylight, mate. Surgeon lies just below, and the air that comes off of him is mortal. There is a tree in Java which if you sleep under it you wake up dead. This is much the same."
"Killick says it ain't catching."
"If it ain't catching, why does the poor bugger take in the victuals at a run, holding his breath with a piece of charcoal in his mouth, and then rush out, daubing his face with vinegar and Gregory's cordial, pale and trembling? Not catching? My arse. I've seen ward after ward of them die in Kingston, till the very land crabs was sick and tired of eating them up."
The third stadium. Pulse, though soft, becomes exceedingly small and unequal. the heat about the precordia increases much. Respiration becomes difficult with frequent sighs. The patient grows yet more anxious and extremely restless. Sweat flows from the face, neck, and breast. Deglutination becomes difficult. Subsultus tendinum comes on. The patient picks the nap of his bedclothes. Coma may last 8, 10, or 12 hours before death. And then on another day, but how many between? He heard the voices loud and clear, dreamlike clear.
Lub lully boy helped them to sponge him. Says he had never seen a body so yellow, like a guinea all over with purple spots. The doctors say if he don't look up in a couple of days, they'll put him over the side come Sunday when the church is rigged.
Sunday came and went with no funeral, and on Tuesday Smith and Macaulay came and said, "Sir, we are now convinced you have avoided the third stadium. Your pulse, though still faint, is a delight to feel, so regular and true. Your excrements a pleasure to inspect. The inner loss of blood has been negligible since Friday, and already your strength is returning. You can almost raise a half-filled glass. Your voice reaches the stern gallery. It will be a long, long, very long while before you can roam the forest again, yet even so we feel that now we may properly congratulate you and give you joy of your recovery."
"Give you joy, sir. Give you joy of your recovery," said Macaulay, and both gently shook his hand.
Long, long it was before Stephen could roam even the sleeping cabin, but once he could really walk, and that on a moving deck, with his stick-like calfless legs, strength returned fast, and a remarkable degree of appetite. While long before he could reach the stern gallery unaided, he sickened of the state of invalidity.
"Sickness has innumerable squalors, many of which you know far too well, my dear," he said when Jack and he were sitting together in the great cabin, "and among them, in some ways the nastiest, is the sufferer's total selfishness. Admittedly, a body doing all it can to survive will naturally turn in upon itself, but the mind inhabiting that body is so inclined to feast on the indulgence, carrying on and on long after the necessity is gone. To my bitter shame, I am almost entirely ignorant of our expedition's success, and even of its whereabouts. From time to time you have told me, in passing, of various captures, emergencies, storms, the all-dreaded Harmattan itself, but little did I hear and little did I retain of a connected narrative. Be so good as to pass another slice of pineapple."
"Why, Mr. Smith said you were not to be disturbed or excited. Above all, not to be excited. And anyhow, when something really interesting happened, like the Aurora and Laurel running down the big Havana schooner, you were always fast asleep."
"Lord, how I slept, indeed! A benign swimming in and out of rosy hibernation. Nothing more healing. But will you not tell me how this side of our mission has gone? What stages we have reached? Whether your expectations are answered?"
"As far as the stage is concerned, we have almost completed our run along the coast. We have gone as far east into the Gulf as I had planned, perhaps farther than I can afford in time, right down to the Bight of Benin. We are now lying off the Slave Coast itself, and tomorrow or the next day I hope the inshore brigs will raise Whydah, the great slave market. Once we have cleaned that up, I shall hand over command of the inshore vessels to Henslow, the senior brig commander, and head for St. Thomas to pick up the southeast trades."
"I remember. Then hay for Freetown and the north."
"Just so. As for our success, I do not think anyone could have expected more, or even as much. We have taken 18 slavers and sent them in with prize crews. All, or almost all, will be condemned, particularly as most of them, taken unawares, we having run ahead of the news, fired upon us, which constitutes piracy."
"Well done, upon my honour. That must surely amount to some 5,000 black men released. I had no notion that you could accomplish so much."
6,120, counting the women. But there were some Portuguese we had to let go, they having a special status if they load in a Portuguese settlement, and a few doubtfuls. For any commander who seizes a vessel that is not breaking the law is liable to be cast in damages, tremendous damages. Yet even so, it was very well. There were some fine active officers aboard the inshore craft and the boats. Hewell was one of them, of course. He comes off tomorrow for orders about Whydah, and if you feel strong enough, I shall ask him to come and read you the log, describing each action in turn. He was in the thick of it, whereas I saw nothing at all, except for the taking of the Havana prize."
"I should like that of all things. And yet, brother, in spite of this striking success, you look sad and worn and anxious. I do not wish to force the least confidence, and if my words are as indiscreet as I fear they may be, I shall not resent a civil evasion. But your violin, which has sustained me all these weeks from the stern gallery, speaks pian pianissimo, and always in D minor. Has the poor ship a hidden leak that cannot be come at? Must she perish?
Jack gazed at him for a long, considering moment, and said, "Sad, yes. I have never liked leading from behind, and the death of many of those young men I have sent in has saddened me deeply. Worn and anxious, I have two reasons, two very good reasons for being both worn and anxious. The first is that the winds, having been so favourable for so long, have now turned cruelly baffling, real Bight of Benin weather, and I am very much afraid, so is Hewell, that they may carry on in the same way for months, preventing us from reaching St. Thomas until it is too late. The second is that if I do succeed in carrying my squadron up to the rendezvous in time to meet the French, I'm not sure how all my ships will behave. It grieves me to say this, Stephen, though a ship being a sounding-board, I do not suppose that much of it will be news to you. The fact of the matter is that two, representing 40% of our guns and about 50% of our broadside weight of metal, are in very bad order. As a result of all our exercising, they can fire tolerably well, and they can get their boats over the side tolerably quick, but they are still in very bad order. Neither is in any way what you would call a happy ship, and both are commanded by men who are not fit to command them. The one is a sodomite, or reputed to be a sodomite, and he is utterly at odds with his officers, while discipline among the hands is all to seek. The other is a bloody tyrant, a flogger, and no seaman. If I did not continually check him, he would have a mutiny on his hands, a very ugly mutiny indeed."
Jack paused, absently cut Stephen another slice of pineapple, and passed it over. Stephen acknowledged it with a bob of his head, but said nothing. It was very unusual for Jack to speak in this way. The flow was not to be interrupted.
"I hate using the ordinary coarse word about Duff, whom I like and who is a fine seaman, and whether he is a sodomite or not I do not give a damn. But as I tried to make him see, you have to check it aboard a man of war. A girl on board is a bad thing. Half a dozen girls would be bedlam. But if a man-lover, is an unchecked sodomite, the whole ship's company is his prey. It will not do. I try to make him see that, but I'm not a very eloquent cove, and I dare say I put it wrong, being so goddamned tactful, because all that worried him was that his manhood, his courage, his conduct, as we say, should be impugned. So long as he was happy to attack, whatever the odds, all was well. It is very difficult. His officers want to arrest him, to bring him to a court-martial, he having angered them so with his favourites. They are said to have witnesses. Damning evidence. If he is found guilty, he must be hanged. That is the only sentence. It is very bad. Very bad for the service. Very bad in every way. I have done what I can in shifting his officers. With the inshore fever and the casualties, there have been several promotions, but his ship is still—"
He shook his head.
"And as for the Purple Emperor, who is not on speaking terms with Duff, by the way, and scarcely with me, he has contrived to gather a set of officers very like himself, not a seaman among them, and even the master needs both watches to put the ship about in anything like a Christian manner. It is the usual West Indies discipline, spit and polish all day long, and flog the last man off the yard, all combined with fine uniforms, brutal ignorance of their profession, and a contempt for bosun captains. Such a band of incompetents as I have never seen gathered together in any one ship belonging to His Majesty."
Jack had remained silent for so long that Stephen ventured to say, "Perhaps in the long haul northwards, with constant exercise and colder seas, the two sick ships will regain a certain health."
"I hope so, indeed," said Jack. "But it would have to be a most uncommon long haul to bring them to anything like Nelson's standard. A complete change of heart in all hands. And with a man like the Purple Emperor, there is no heart to change, no person left, only a set of pompous attitudes. Though, to be sure, exercise, and we offshore people have been thoroughly idle, and cold seas can do wonders. Stephen, was you to be propped up with cushions, do you think you could hold your cello? The sea is smooth. With a couple of turns round your middle, you would not be flung about."
When Hewell came aboard from the Sestos's cutter, he found both Commodore and Captain on the quarter-deck, looking pleased. And when, after the usual obeisances, he asked how the doctor did, the Commodore nodded his head aft, and Hewell, listening attentively, heard the deep, melodious, though somewhat unsteady voice of the cello.
"It takes more than the Yellow Jack to come to an end of him," said the Commodore. "Come along with me, and when you have made your report, I will take you in. He longs to know how things have been going along inshore."
They walked aft, and in the passage Hewell said,
"My report is very brief, sir. Whydah is empty. The news ran ahead of us at last, and there is not a slaver left in the road that we could touch with safety."
"I am heartily glad of it," said Jack,
and he carried on into the great cabin, where Stephen sat lashed into an elbow chair, looking like an ancient child.
"Doctor," cried Jack, "I have brought you Mr. Hewell, who tells me that Whydah is empty. I am heartily glad of it, for we cannot spare officers and men for any more prize crews. We are far below complement already, with so many of them bowsing up their jibs in Freetown. What is more, it allows us to leave this infernal coast at once, steering for St. Thomas and something like breathable air. But since the breeze is dead contrary at present, and likely to remain so until after sunset, I shall stand in, say farewell to the brigs and schooners, and then give those scoundrels in the town and the barracoons a salute that will put the fear of God into them. Mr. Hewell, I shall send you the logbook rough sheets, so that you can tell the doctor about each action in turn."
Orders could be heard on deck, and the patter of feet overhead as the signal hoists were prepared. Already the helm was hard over, and the ship was turning, turning, her motion gradually changing from roll to pitch as she headed for the land.
"Look at that infernal lubber,"
cried Hewell, pointing at the Thames, two cables' length astern and in the Bellona's wake. Stephen could discern something flapping about among the sails, and a certain deviation either side of the line traced by the pennant ship, but his seamanship could not name the crime committed, heinous though it must have been. The rough sheets came, but before reading them Hewell asked after Square and Stephen's journey up the Sinon River.
"Square was all that could possibly have been wished," said Stephen. "I am most grateful to you for the recommendation, and although my little expedition was pitifully short, I saw many wonders, and I brought back a wealth of specimens."
"I wonder whether you saw your Potto. I remember you particularly wished to see the Potto of those parts."
"I saw one, sure, and an eminently gratifying sight he was, but I was unable to bring him home."
"In that case I have one aboard the Sestos, if you would like her. But I am afraid she is only the Calabar kind, without a tail, an Awantibo, a she-Potto. I thought of you at once when I saw her in the market."
"Nothing, nothing would give me greater pleasure," cried Stephen. "I am infinitely obliged to you, dear Mr. Hewell. A Calabar Potto within 2 or 3 hours' sail, or even less with this beautiful sweet-scented breeze. What joy!"
The activities of the inshore squadron took up the hour or so before dinner, which Hewell ate with a commodore, the captain, the first lieutenant, and a scrubbed, speechless midshipman. They took their coffee on the poop, supporting Stephen up the ladder, and by now a vast expanse of Africa was to be seen ahead, lagoons glittering along the coast, very tall palms just visible, and greenness, often very dark, stretching away inland until it merged with the indefinite horizon and the sky. The midshipman made his barely audible blushing acknowledgements and vanished. The superior officers followed him after no more than a glass of brandy, and Hewell said,
"There, on the far bank of the lagoon, about halfway along, is Whydah. May I pass you the telescope?"
"If you please. So that is the great slave market. Yet I see no port, no harbour."
"No, sir. Whydah has nothing of that kind. Everything has to be landed or taken off through the frightful surf, see how it breaks, then run up the beach and so ferried across the lagoon. The Mina, who do it all, have wonderful surf boats, but even so things get lost."
"Surely that is a very curious arrangement for a large commercial town."
"Yes, sir. But there are precious few real ports all along the coast. And then again, Dahomey, that is to say practically everything we are looking at, is an inland kingdom. Their capital is right up country. They know nothing about the sea, and they dislike the coast. But they are a very warlike nation, perpetually raiding their neighbours to capture the slaves they exchange for European goods. So they use Whydah, which is more or less under their rule, as the nearest place, inconvenient though it is. And since they export thousands and thousands of Negroes every year, it has grown to be a considerable place, with English, French, and Portuguese quarters, and some Arabs and Yorubas."
"I see a great deal of green among the houses."
"Oranges and limes and lemons everywhere, sir. A delight after a long passage. I remember squeezing a squirt together into a bowl and quaffing it straight off when first I was here. Things were not so cleverly arranged in those days, and there was some goods you had to carry all the way to Abomey, the king's great town, or in the hottest weather to Kana, his smaller place."
"I do not think I have ever read a description of a great African town.
I mean a Negro town, as opposed to a Moorish." "A very curious sight it is, sir.
Abome has a wall 6 miles round, 20 feet high, with 6 gates. There is the king's house, a vast great place, surprisingly high and lined with skulls. Skulls on the walls, skulls on posts, skulls everywhere, and jawbones. And then, of course, there are great numbers of ordinary yew houses. They all speak yew in those parts, made of mud with thatched roofs, and some what you might call palaces, a marketplace of perhaps 40 or 50 acres, and a huge spreading barracks.
How did the people use you?
The Dahomey are fine, upstanding set of men, civil, though reserved. Yet I had the impression that they looked down on me, which they did, of course, being so much taller, but I mean out of pride. Still, I do not remember that any of the men behaved in a way you could object to, and since I had brought a dozen chests of capital iron war hats for his Amazons, the king ordered me to be given a gold fetizo wearing a good quarter of a pound.
Did you say his Amazons, Mr. Hewell?
Why, yes, sir, the Dahomey Amazons. And seeing that Stephen was in no way enlightened, he went on, "The most effective part of the king's army is made up of young females, sir, terribly bold and fierce. I never saw more than 1,000 at a time when some particular bands were marching past, but I was assured there were many more. It was for them that I brought the iron war hats."
"They are actually warriors, sir?
Not merely camp followers?" "Indeed they are, sir, and by all accounts quite terrible, fearless and terrible. They have the post of honour in battle and attack first."
"I am amazed."
"So was I, sir, when a pack of, I suppose, female sergeants made me go into their hut and fit them with their war hats. I was younger then, and not as ill-looking as I am now, and they used me shamefully. I blush for it yet."
He hung his head, regretting having begun the anecdote.
Stephen said, "You're infinitely welcome, Potter, Mr. Hewell. Is she as strictly nocturnal as her cousin the common Potter?"
"Sir, I have no notion at all. She was there in the market, curled up in a ball under some straw in the bottom of a fine brass wire cage, and when I asked what was there, the old woman said, 'Potter.' It would have been no satisfaction to anyone not to haggle a little, and I knocked off the equivalent of 4 pence for no tale. But in the end she had a price that made her laugh with pleasure, and she said I might have some little books and pictures into the bargain. She had been a popish missionary's housekeeper, you see, and she was selling what he had left. Everything had gone except these books and papers and the porto, which the people of all the nations in Huayda, even the houses, suspected of being a Roman fetizo, which might offend the local spirits. I carried her aboard the Cestos, and just before I turned in, I saw her looking at me with eyes like saucers. But she did not seem to like the sight, and she shrank back into the straw almost at once, though I offered her a piece of banana. That is all I know of her, except that she would have been boiled tomorrow if she had not found a customer."
"You would not have her with you at all in that elegant boat, dear Mr. Hewell?"
"Oh, no. Movement seems to distress her, and we had to beat into a heavy head sea, but I did bring the drawings and the books."
The books were an Elsevier Pomponius Mela De Situ Orbis, a breviary worn almost to destruction, and a thick notebook filled at one end with equivalents in various African languages, and at the other with personal reflections and what appeared to be drafts of letters. The drawings were painstaking, inexpert representations of the Potto in different attitudes, tailless, anxious.
"I am sorry to be disappointing," said Hewell, "but the squadron is running in at rather better than 8 knots. There, over to starboard, you can see our brigs and schooners, and in a few minutes I must hurry ahead with orders. All ships and vessels are to fire a royal salute of 21 guns.
"Why, for all love, this is not Oak Apple Day or any other great occasion.
In order to impress Huayda and the King of Dahomey, and it can be justified as being the birthday of a member of the royal family. Well, almost. Mr. Adams ran right through the book and came up with the Duke of Habakstal, who was born today, a close cousin, I believe. Anyhow, royal enough for the purpose."
That ill-omened name was never wholly remote from Stephen's thoughts, but today it had retreated farther than usual, and the sudden, wholly unexpected sound of it cast a singular damp upon his happiness. Hewell set off for the Huayda road, leaving the drawings and other things by Stephen's side. Presently he took out the notebook, and turning to the back, he at once came upon a smaller drawing of both a Potto and a creature very like it that he took to be Lemur tardigradus, with the following text, apparently meant for a fellow member of the Congregation of the Holy Ghost. In her manners she is for the most part gentle, except in the cold season, when her temper seemed wholly changed, and her Creator, who made her so sensible to cold, to which she must often have been exposed even in her native forests, gave her her thick fur, which we rarely see in animals in these tropical climates. To me, who not only constantly fed her, but bathed her twice a week in water accommodated to the seasons, and whom she clearly distinguished from others, she was at all times grateful. But when I disturbed her in winter, she was usually indignant, and seemed to reproach me with the uneasiness which she felt, though no possible precaution had been omitted to keep her in a proper degree of warmth. At all times she was pleased with being stroked on the head, and frequently suffered me to touch her extremely sharp teeth, but her temper was always quick, and when she was unreasonably disturbed she expressed a little resentment by an obscure murmur like that of a squirrel. From half an hour after sunrise to half an hour before sunset she slept without intermission, rolled up like a hedgehog, and as soon as she awoke she began to prepare herself for the labours of her approaching day, licking and dressing herself like a cat, an operation which the flexibility of her neck and limbs enabled her to perform very completely. She was then ready for a slight breakfast, after which she commonly took a short nap, but when the sun was quite set she recovered all her vivacity. A little before daybreak, when my early hours gave me frequent opportunities of observing her, she seemed to solicit my attention, and if I presented my finger to her she licked or nibbled it with great gentleness, but eagerly took fruit when I offered it, though she seldom ate much at her morning repast. When the day brought back her night, her eyes lost their lustre and strength, and she composed herself for a slumber of 10 or 11 hours. The missionary's writing was difficult to make out, irregular and trembling, the hand of a very sick or aged man, and by the time Stephen had come to the bottom of the page, the Bellona, her consort, and all the inshore vessels had formed a line of parallel with the shore, lying to on the declining breeze at little more than point-blank range of the immense crowds blackening the strand. He had heard the usual orders, the hoarse cry of Mears the master gunner and his mate, and he knew that a salute was to be fired. Yet nothing had prepared him for the prodigious bellowing uproar that followed the Bellona's first discharge. The people on the strand were equally surprised, or even more so, and several thousand fell flat, covering their heads. The noise was not quite so great, nor the smoke banks quite so dense, as they had been at Freetown, but the whole was more concentrated. And when Stephen could hear himself think again, he felt that Jack Aubrey was probably right, and that the slave trade as a whole had received a setback worth 1,000 times the cost in powder. Shot there was none. For the Potto he was not greatly concerned. Creatures that lived within the zone of tropical storms, the enormous thunder breaking just over their heads, could put up with anything the Royal Navy might be able to offer, particularly those that slept all day with their heads between their knees. Certainly this was the case with the present Potto. When Hewell and Square brought her aboard and carried her down to Maturin's little cabin on the orlop, he did not trust Jack not to talk loud and chuck her under the chin, which would not do until she was used to life aboard. He sat with her a great while by the light of a single purser's dip. At about sunset she came out, looking nervous to be sure, as any country Potto might in new surroundings, but neither shattered nor terrified. She would have nothing to do with his proffered banana, still less with a finger, but she washed, to some extent, a very beautiful little creature, and a little before he left he saw one of the far too many local cockroaches walk into her cage. Her immense eyes glowed with an uncommon fire. She paused, motionless, until it was within reach, and then seized it with both hands. Yet for eating the animal, which she did with every appearance of appetite, she used but one, and that the left.
"Good night, dear Potter," he said, locking the door behind him.
His way led him through the after cockpit, the midshipman's berth, at present filled with 12 boys and young men engaged in eating their supper, throwing pieces of biscuit and shouting at one another. They all leapt up at the sight of the doctor, asked him how he did, said they were very happy to see him on his pins, but he must not overdo it, particularly so soon, and at his age. He must take care. With this blessed t'gallant breeze off the land, she was pitching into the swell like Leda's swan. And the two senior master's mates, Upex and Tyndall, insisted upon leading him up the ladder to the gun deck, each holding an elbow, so to the upper deck and thence to the quarter deck, where he was considered safe and capable of walking aft, with the first lieutenant's help, as far as the cabin.
"Heaven, Stephen!" cried Jack,
I thought you were asleep in the bedplace. I've been walking about on tiptoe and drinking my sherry in an undertone."
"I was sitting with my Potto in the orlop," said Stephen, "she being a nocturnal creature. What amiable young fellows they are in the cockpit."
"Certainly. They are settling down now, growing far less obnoxious. There are one or two may make seamen given 50 years or so. But what a feat to creep up from the orlop in your state of health. I trust they gave you a hand."
"Perhaps it was more a question of mutual support," said Stephen. "My strength is coming back hand over fist."
"Hand over fist," he repeated the nautical phrase with a certain complacency. Yet although he lied shamefully with one half of his mouth, the other spoke gospel truth. Day after day this beautiful wind blew nobly, carrying the squadron out of the accursed bight under a press of sail, once to the extent of skyscrapers aboard the Thames after her signal "Make more sail" had been 3 times repeated, the 3rd repetition emphasized with a windward gun. And day after day Stephen grew brisker, more agile, and, like the Potto, greedier. Many of the sick from the inshore vessels were now aboard the Bellona and other ships of the squadron, most with fevers of one kind or another. Tertians, double tertians, remittents and quartans for the most part, though there were 3 cases of the yellow jack. And very soon Dr. Maturin was making at least his morning rounds, with Square in attendance to help him up on deck, where he would stand for half a glass or so, revelling with Jack, Tom, and all hands present in the squadron's pace, as the breeze came whistling in either over the starboard or the larboard bow. No longer a soldier's wind right aft, as it had been the 1st day they sank the shore, but never heading them either, so that they beat steadily towards the line, making legs a whole watch long.
"This has never been known in the memory of the oldest Guineaman," said Mr. Woodbine, the master, "and there are some hands who say your Potto has brought the ship good luck."
A marine officer on the quarter-deck added,
"My servant Joe Andrews tells me that many of the old African hands say there is nothing like a Potto for luck. And after all, there is a Potto's field in the Bible, is there not?"
"Is it true,"
Jack asked Stephen at supper,
"that Barker and Overley are on the mend?"
"It is true," said Stephen, who had sat with them for hours, first persuading their neighbours that the yellow fever was not infectious. They would not speak to the poor men else, nor breathe their breath, but remained turned utterly away, and then assuring the patients themselves that they had a very fair chance if they held on with all their might and never gave way to despair. No one could possibly have had more authority in this instance, and although the 3rd man, very far gone, died almost at once, Barker and Overley were likely to find another way to heaven.
"Ah," said Jack, nodding his head, "that was a famous stroke, bringing your Potto aboard."
"Why, you're sold to the devil, Jack Aubrey, for a vile, wicked pagan, and an infamously superstitious dog to be so weak," cried Stephen, nettled for once.
"Oh, I beg pardon," said Jack, blushing. "I did not mean that at all. Not at all. I only meant it comforted the hands. I am sure your physic did them a power of good, too. I make no sort of doubt of it."
Beating up. Beating steadily up into winds mostly west of south, often changeable but never still. None of those wicked clock calms of the gulf with its dense fever-bearing mists drifting off the shore. And by the time they raised St. Thomas, a cloud-capped peak soaring above the horizon at 70 leagues in the south-southeast, a half-east, Stephen had put on a stone, and his breeches would stay up without a pin.
"There is our salvation!" cried he, having been called from a peaceful sleep to view the peak in question.
"How do you mean, our salvation?"
asked Jack suspiciously. He had often been led out of his way, or had been attempted to be led out of his way, by remote islands said to harbour a cousin of the phoenix, a very curious wren, or the loveless bowers of parthenogenetic lizards. This was in the Aegean, and he had no intention of landing Dr. Maturin on St. Thomas for another of his timeless rambles. A seaman's eye could already make out the particular cloud formation of the longed-for southeast trades a great way off on the starboard bow.
"My dear Commodore, how can you be so strange? Is it not I that have been telling you this mortal week and more that I have barely a dram of cinchona, of Jesuit's bark, left in the dispensary at all? Have not my fever cases drunk it up day and night? Did not other ships borrow several Winchester quarts? Was not a whole carboy broke by a great oaf I shall not name? And is not St. Thomas, the island of the world for bark of the finest quality, guaranteed to clear the sick berth out of hand? And not only bark, but the kindly fruits of the earth, whose lack is now becoming evident."
"It will mean the loss of a day," said Jack.
though I must admit that I did hear some obscure, muttered complaints about bark, both in quantity and quality.
"Jesuit's bark is the one sovereign specific against fever," said Stephen. "We must have Jesuit's bark."
In circumstances that he could no longer exactly recall, probably during a feast at the Keppel's Head in Portsmouth, Jack had once said that
"a Jesuit's bark was worse than his bite,"
a remark received with infinite mirth, cordial admiration. He smiled at the recollection, and looking at his friend's earnest, guileless face, no parthenogenetic lizards there, he said,
"Very well, but it must be touch and go, just the time to hurry ashore, buy a dozen bottles of bark and away. And don't I wish that may be the case," he added to himself.
It was not, of course. It never was the case in any but a British port. First there was the matter of the salute. None of His Majesty's ships might salute any foreign fort, governor or local dignitary, without having first made certain that the same number of guns would be returned. This meant sending in an officer, accompanied by an interpreter. Fortunately, Mr. Adams had a certain amount of Portuguese. Then there was the question of pratique. After the 15 covenanted guns had boomed to and fro across Chaves Bay, a man from the captain of the port came out in a handsome galley, and on hearing that the squadron was last from the slave coast, he looked grave and said that since there had been an outbreak of the plague in Whydah 3 years ago, they would have to perform quarantine before anyone could be allowed on shore. Stephen reasoned with him privately, so convincingly that the regulations were slightly eased. The doctor and a boat from each ship might spend a few hours ashore, but no one was to go more than 100 paces from the high tide mark. As most people in the squadron expected, the second lieutenant of the Thames and the young marine officer from the Stately, who had been Stephen's neighbour at dinner, took this opportunity, the first, to settle their disagreement. They and their seconds went more than 100 paces from the shore, but not much, there being a convenient coconut grove at hand. Here the ground was measured out, and at the drop of a handkerchief each young man shot the other in the belly. Each was carried back to his boat, and the question of the Stately's manliness and fighting qualities remained undecided.
"Did you know about this rencontre, Stephen?" asked Jack that evening, when St. Thomas was sinking on the southern rim of the sea, and the Bellona, making up for the loss of time with stunsails aloft and alow, spread to the southeast trades.
"Faith, I was there when the provocation was given."
"If you had told me, I might have prevented it."
"Nonsense. There was a direct offence, and the Stately's marine was bound to resent it. No apology was offered, no withdrawal, and this was the necessary result, as you know very well."
Jack could not deny it. He shook his head.
"Oh, I hope the young fellow don't die. If he do, poor Duff is like to hang himself. Do you think he will recover? The Stately, I mean."
"The dear knows. I have not seen him. It was over before I had done with the apothecary, and all I saw was their blood on the strand. But an abdominal wound very often has a fatal issue if the viscera are injured."
In the event, both young men died, though not before the second lieutenant, at the urging of the Thames's chaplain, had acknowledged that he was in the wrong, and had sent a proper message to Willoughby, the Royal Marine, who returned his thanks and best wishes for a prompt recovery. This reconciliation, however, was confined to those who had fought. The hostility between the two ships increased, and it was made evident on all possible occasions by cries of
"What ho, the Molly ship!"
if there was time, or
"The Puffs ahoy!"
if there was not, on the part of the Thames, and of
"Slack in the stays!"
or
"Make more sail there!"
from the Stately. Not that there were many occasions for rudeness, for although the beautiful trade wind varied in strength, it never declined to anything near enough to one of those calms so usual in the doldrums for ordinary ship-visiting among the hands to be possible, or for it to be easy for the officers of any one ship to invite those of another. Nor did the Commodore ever create an artificial calm by lying to, even on Sundays. He was haunted by the dread of being late, and although on days less blowy than usual he would summon the Ringle and run up the line to see how his captains were coming along, he consistently urged his maxim,
"Lose not a minute! There is not a minute to be lost!"
and obeyed it himself, even to the point of forbidding the ships he visited to reduce sail to let him come aboard more easily. He dined once in the Stately, and although he had shifted her first lieutenant, the most inveterate against Captain Duff and the man who had wished to arrest him, to the command of a brig, he was sorry to find a marked degree of tension at the captain's table, the officers ill at ease, and Duff, though a good host, anxious and wanting in authority.
"He is a good, kind fellow, and he handles his ship like a prime seaman, but he seems incapable of taking a hint," said Jack on returning.
Yet this was the one sad day out of the 10, 10 no more, and but for the heavy sailing Thames it would have been 8, that it took to run up to Freetown, and the rest of the time was delightful sailing, a world to which they had grown so accustomed in the vast stretches of the Pacific, and to which they returned as to the natural way of life, with all the shipboard ceremonies and routines in their due order, as exactly marked by bells as those of a monastery. 8 bells in the middle watch, when those whose duty it was to show the sun a spotless deck had to leave their hammocks 2 hours before he rose. 8 bells in the forenoon watch, when the officers fixed the height of the noonday sun and hands were piped to dinner. Bells and pipes all day long, with some music too. The drum beating Heart of Oak for the wardroom dinner, though Aurora, whose marine officer had organized a band among his men, did it in a higher style. The drum again for quarters and the retreat, and on most evenings fiddles, bagpipes, or a little shrill fife playing for the hands as they danced on the forecastle. Bells all night long, too, though somewhat muted. These formal measures and divisions had, of course, been there during the wearisome creep along the shores of the Gulf, the Bellona often lying too, doing nothing. But it was only now that they regained their full significance, and in a surprisingly short time this part of the voyage seemed to have been going on forever. For Jack and Stephen, too, the evening resumed their old familiar pattern of supper and music, occasionally chess or cards if the seas were heavy enough to shake Stephen's control of his cello, or rambling talk of common friends, former voyages, rarely about the future, an anxious prospect for both and one they tended to shy away from. "Jack," said Stephen, when the ship's pitching had obliged him to lay down his bow. He spoke rather diffidently, knowing how Jack disliked any topic that might reflect discredit on the service.
"Would it grieve you to tell me a little more about sodomy in the Navy? One often hears about it, and the perpetual reiteration of the Articles of War, with their unnatural and detestable sin of buggery, makes it seem part of the nautical landscape. Yet apart from your very first command, the brig Sophie—"
"She was a sloop," said Jack quite sharply.
"But she had 2 masts. I remember them perfectly. One in the front, and the other, if you follow me, behind. Whereas a sloop, as you never cease pointing out, has but one, more or less, in the middle."
"If she has no masts at all, or 50, she would still have been a sloop from the moment my commission had been read aboard her. For I was a commander, a master and commander, and anything a commander commands instantly becomes a sloop."
"Well, in that vessel there was a sailor who could not command his passion, for a goat, as I remember. But apart from that I scarcely remember any instance, and by now I am a very old and experienced salt dog."
"I do not suppose you do, but when you consider what the lower deck is like, 300 or 400 men packed tight, the cloud of witnesses when hammocks are piped down, and the very public nature of the heads, it is difficult to imagine a more unsuitable place for such capers. Yet it does occasionally happen in what few holes and corners a man of war possesses, and in cabins. I remember a horrid case of Corsica in 96. Blanche, Captain Sawyer, Meleager, Captain Coburn, George Coburn, both 12-pounder, 32-gun frigates, had been there in company the year before, and something ugly of that kind involving Sawyer had taken place. You remember George Coburn, Stephen?"
"Certainly, a very fine man indeed. The best kind of a sailor."
"Summoned those men of both ships who knew about it and made them swear to keep the whole damn thing quiet. Yes. But the next year Sawyer began again, calling foremast jacks to his cabin and putting out the light. And of course he favoured these fellows and would not allow his officers to compel them to do their duty, and of course discipline began to go to the dogs. After a good deal of this his first lieutenant called for a court-martial, which was granted, and Sawyer fought back by bringing charges against almost the whole gunroom. Poor George Coburn was in a horrible position. He had certain evidence of the man's guilt in private letters he had written to him, that Sawyer had written to Coburn. But they were private, as confidential as letters could be. Yet, on the other hand, if Sawyer were acquitted, all his officers were ruined, and a man who should not be in command would remain in command. So for the good of the service he showed them, looking like death as he did so, and for long after. The judges twisted the evidence round and round, like a keckle on a cable, and found Sawyer not guilty of the act itself, but only of gross indecency, so he was not hanged, but dismissed the service. Darcy Preston, a countryman of yours, I believe?"
"Of the Gormanston family. I must tell you about their manner of death one day. Pray go on."
"Darcy Preston succeeded him for a short while, and then Nelson, Commodore at the time, appointed Henry Hotham, a right taut disciplinarian, for the Blanche was still in wretched bad order. Indeed, the people were so far gone in disobedience and loving their ease that they would not receive him. They said he was a damned Tartar and would neither receive him nor hear his commission read. They pointed the forecastle guns aft and turned him out of the ship. Eventually Nelson himself came over, bringing Hotham with him. He told the Blanche's people that they had the best name of any frigate's crew in the Navy. They had taken two heavier frigates in fair fight, and were they now going to rebel? If Captain Hotham used them ill, they were to write him a letter and he would support them. On this they gave three cheers and returned to their duty while he went back to his ship, leaving Hotham in command. But it did not last. As a crew they were beyond recall. The rot had gone so deep. And as soon as they reached Portsmouth, they petitioned to be given another captain or another ship.
Were they indulged in either?
Of course not. They would have been scattered among any number of short-handed ships. As for our case, or what looks something like our case, I shall advise with James Wood when we reach Freetown and see what can be done by a thorough shake-up and perhaps some more transfers. But for now, let us have another glass of wine. The port stands up wonderfully well in this heat, don't you find? And go back to our Boccherini.
They did so. But Jack played indifferently. His heart was no longer in the music, and Stephen wondered how he could have been so heavy, knowing his friend's devotion to the service, as to raise the subject in spite of his own misgivings. He consoled himself with the reflection that salt water washes all away, that another 100 miles of this perfect sailing would raise Jack's spirits, and that Freetown would see his difficulties resolved. Freetown, on a fine, clear afternoon. The immense harbour dotted with ships belonging to the Royal Navy and some Guineamen, who began saluting Commodore Aubrey's pennant with seamanlike promptitude. The Ringle had been sent ahead of the squadron, carrying word to the Governor, and as soon as the Bellona was comfortably anchored and the whole squadron trim, with yards squared by lifts and braces, Jack, followed by his subordinate commanders, went ashore in style to wait upon His Excellency. Number one uniform, presentation sword, gold-laced hat, Nile medal. For as soon as the ship had made his number, Government House had thrown out the signal inviting him and his captains to dinner. The Bellona's barge was a fine spectacle, new-painted, pulled by as neat a set of bargemen as any in the fleet, most of them Jack's followers from ship to ship, and steered by Bondon, grave, conscious of the occasion, in exactly the same rig as Tom Allen, Nelson's coxswain, whom he resembled, with Mr. Weatherby beside him, an infant from the gunroom, who had to be shown how to deal with such ceremonies. The Bellona's barge—it was in fact her launch, but being rowed by bargemen and acting as a barge, it assumed the somewhat grander name—pulled 14 oars, and when these 14 men were not wholly taken up with the exact regularity of their stroke, they looked aft with a certain disapproval. Their surgeon and his man had come for the ride, and they let the side down, shabby, unbrushed, and carrying an old green umbrella badly furled.
"Why, that idle sod Killick ever let him out looking like Georgia Green, I cannot tell,"
whispered Bow Oar.
"Never mind," replied his mate out of the side of his mouth. "He ain't going to the palace."
He and Square were in fact going to the marketplace to seek out Humusios at the earliest possible opportunity, and then to hurry over the swamp, there to sit under his umbrella, contemplating the long-legged wading birds, even perhaps the fishing vulture, with his perspective glass. And he was strangely dashed when, on coming to the money-changer's stall, they found only Socrates, who said that Mr. Humusios was gone on a journey into the interior, but would be back on Friday. Stephen was strangely dashed, strangely put about, but having considered for a while, he told Square to go and rejoice with his family and walked slowly off in the direction of the fetid swamp, much reduced in this dry season, but still fetid, still a swamp, and with the birds concentrated in a smaller area. And what might he not hope for? Adanson had worked extremely hard, but he had been farther to the north, on the banks of the Senegal, and even Adanson had not turned every egg.
"Doctor! Doctor!"
they cried, hallooing far behind.
"They are calling for a doctor, the creatures," he reflected. "Don't they wish they may find one? Does the chanting goshawk come so far south, I wonder?"
"Doctor! Doctor!"
they called, hoarse with running, and at last he stopped.
"The Commodore says pray come directly," gasped a midshipman. "His Excellency invites you to dinner."
"My compliments and thanks to His Excellency," said Stephen, "but regret I am unable to accept."
He moved on towards the fetid swamp.
"Come, sir, that won't do," said a tall sergeant. "You'll be getting us into cruel trouble, which we have orders to escort you back, and we shall be brought to the Triangle and flogged else.
Come, sir, if you please."
Stephen looked at the three breathless but determined master's mates, the powerful marine, and gave in.
"My dear sir," cried the governor, "I beg you will overlook the short notice, the unceremonious invitation, but the last time you were here I did not have the pleasure, the honour of meeting you, and when my wife heard that Dr. Maturin, Dr. Stephen Maturin, had been in Sierra Leone without dining here, she was infinitely distressed, desolated, quite put out. Allow me to introduce you."
He led Stephen up to a very good-looking young woman, tall, fair, agreeably plump, smiling at him with the utmost benevolence.
"I ask your pardon, ma'am, for appearing before you in this squalid—"
"Not in the very least," she cried, taking both his hands. "You are covered, covered with laurels. I am Edward Heatherley's sister, and I have read all your lovely books and papers, including your address to the Institute, which Monsieur Cuvier sent over to Edward."
Edward Heatherley, a very shy young man, a naturalist and a member, though rarely seen, of the Royal Society, with a moderate estate in the north of England, where he lived as quietly as possible with this sister, both of them collecting, botanizing, drawing, dissecting, and above all, comparing. They had articulated skeletons of all the British mammals, and Edward had told Stephen, one of his few intimates, that she knew bones far better than he did. She was unbeatable on bats. This passed through, or rather, appeared in his mind so rapidly that there was no measurable pause before his reply of,
"Miss Christine, I am delighted to see you, ma'am, and now I do not mind my squalor in the least."
Captain James Wood, the governor, possessed a maiden sister who had looked after much of his official entertaining before his marriage, which was just as well, for although Mrs. Governor kept remembering her duty and doing it, few sailors could engage her real attention when a famous natural philosopher was by.
"You must certainly come tomorrow," she said as they parted, "and I will show you my garden and my creatures. I have a chanting goshawk and a brush-tailed porcupine, and perhaps you might like to see my bones."
"Nothing could possibly give me greater pleasure," said Stephen, pressing her hand.
"And perhaps we might walk by the swamp."
"Well, Stephen, you were in luck, upon my word," said Jack as they walked down to the boat. "The only pretty woman of the party, and you completely monopolized her. And in the drawing-room she came and sat at your knee and talked to no one else for hours on end."
"We had a great deal to talk about. She knows more on the subject of bones and their variations, from species to species, than any woman I am acquainted with. Much more, indeed, than most men, and they professed anatomists. She is sister to Edward Heatherley, whom you may have seen at the Royal. A fine young woman."
"What a pleasure. I love talking to women like that. Caroline Herschel and I used to prattle away about Pomeranian sludge and the last stages of a telescope's mirror halfway through the night. But knowing and beautiful, too. What bliss! Yet how she ever came to marry James Wood, I cannot tell. A fair practical seaman, and an excellent fellow, but never an idea in his head, and he is at least twice her age."
"Other people's marriages are a perpetual source of amazement," said Stephen.
They walked on, rejecting first the offer of a sedan chair, and then that of a hammock slung on a pole and carried by two men, a usual conveyance in those parts.
"You two seemed to be enjoying yourselves very heartily at your end of the table," said Stephen after a while.
"So we were. There were some people from the Vice Admiralty Court and the Civil Secretary, and they were telling us how well we had done, how very much better than anyone else, how much wealthier we should be when everything was settled up, above all if none of the alleged Americans or Spaniards won an appeal against their decisions, which was most improbable, and how well our hands would do with their undisputed share, which was ready in canvas bags in the Treasury, ready to be paid out. And, Stephen, now it is the dry season, you will not keep them aboard all night?"
"I will not, though you know very well what the result will be.
But, brother, there is a glee radiating from you that was never aroused by prize money, dearly though you love it. You would never have heard from the Admiralty at all?" "Oh, no. I should not expect anything yet, if ever. We saved a wonderful amount of time on that last leg. No, I have letters from home," tapping his bosom. "And so have you, but from Spain."
Stephen's letter was from Avila. Clarissa reported a quiet, agreeable life, a healthy, affectionate, and biddable child, now garrulous and tolerably correct in English, with some Spanish, but preferring the Irish she spoke with Padine. She was learning her letters quite well, but was puzzled about which hand to write them with. Stephen's aunt Petronilla was very kind to Bridget, to them both. Some of the ladies who lived in the convent had carriages and took them for drives, wrapped in furs. It was a severe winter, and two of Stephen's cousins, one coming from Segovia and the other from Madrid, had heard wolves close to the road at noon. She herself was well, mildly happy, reading as she had not read for years, and she liked the nuns' singing. Sometimes she went with Perdine, who sent his duty, to the Benedictine church for the plain chant. Enclosed was a small, square piece of paper, not over clean, with a drawing of a wolf with teeth, and some words that Stephen could not make out until he realized that they were Irish, written phonetically.
"Oh, my father, farewell, Brigid."
He sat in the cabin savoring this, and drinking thin lime juice for some considerable time, before Jack came in from the stern gallery, looking equally happy. He said,
"I have had such delightful letters from Sophie, who sends you her dear love, and I mean to answer them this minute. There is a merchantman on the wing for Southampton. Stephen, how do you spell Peccavi?"
Christine Heatherly had quite charmed Dr. Maturin. He lay in his cot that night, swinging to the long Atlantic swell and thinking about his afternoon, and he had a startlingly clear visual image of her speaking earnestly about clavicles in primates, her eyes particularly wide open. "Can it be that her physical presence has stirred long dormant emotions in my, let us say, bosom?" he wondered. The answer, "No. My motives are entirely pure," came at almost the same moment that another part of his mind was considering the gentle pressure of her hand. Kindness? Her brother's friendship? A certain inclination? "No," he replied again. "My motives being entirely pure, she feels perfectly safe with me, middle-aged, ill-formed, wizened from the yellow jack, and can be as free as with her grandfather, or at least her uncle. Yet out of respect for her and for Government House, I shall desire Killick to unpack, curl, and powder my best wig against tomorrow's visit." In the morning he rose early, saying, "I shall not shave until after my rounds and breakfast, when I shall have light enough to shave extremely close." But when his rounds were over, and they were quite long, with several new cases of an intractable rash that he had never seen elsewhere, the light was still extremely poor. On his way up he met Killick, and speaking loud over the curious circumambient sound, he asked him both to attend to the wig, and to lay out his good satin breeches and a clean shirt, adding that he was about to ask the first lieutenant for a boat in the forenoon.
"No forenoon, no, nor no afternoon to-day, sir, which there's a smoke on, and you can't hardly breathe on deck, nor no boat could swim. Harmerton, some say, a right guinea smoke. You won't want no wig?"
No, and had he worn one, he would have lost it. The moment he put his head above the level of the quarter-deck, his meagre locks were whipped away to the south-west, and he understood that the noise he heard was that of a very curious, very furious north-east wind. Hot, extraordinarily parching dry, and so loaded with red-brown dust that at times one could scarcely see 20 yards beyond the side. But those 20 yards of visible sea were whipped to a continuous chopping froth against the swell.
"Smoke, sir," said Squire at his side, "but only a little one, over tomorrow or the next day."
"How I hope you are right," said Stephen. "I particularly wish to see Mr. Humusius."
And as he spoke, he felt the red dust gritting between his teeth. A disappointing day, and quite extraordinarily thirsty, yet it did have some wonders of its own. Jack, who as usual was making what observations were possible, observations of temperature at various depths, salinity, humidity of the air, and so on, for his friend Humboldt, showed Stephen his sea chest, which had been brought up onto the half-deck so that the joiner might add an additional till or tray, a very stout chest indeed, that had seen and survived almost every kind of weather the world could offer. But the Harmerton had split its lid, a broad cleft from one end to the other.
"We are playing the fire hose on the boats to keep them whole," he observed in a cheerful roar.
Square was right about the duration, however, and Thursday saw a world which, though ravaged, covered with rufous dust feet deep in sheltered places, and generally flattened, was at least calm, and a close-shaven Stephen Maturin, neatly dressed, pulled ashore over a filthy, gently heaving sea. Since he was carrying a gift of sunbirds, or rather their skins arranged with the feathers outwards, as beautiful as any bouquet, and far more lasting, he took a sedan chair to Government House, where he would have sent in his name if Mrs. Wood had not thrown up a window with a little shriek and called out to ask him how he did. She would be down in a minute, she said.
And so she was, having paused only to change her shoes and put on a singularly becoming cashmere shawl.
"I am so sorry about this odious Harmerton," she said. "It has utterly destroyed my garden. But perhaps, when we have had some coffee, you might like to look at some dried specimens and the bones."
The bones were indeed worth looking at, beautifully arranged, often articulated with a dexterity few could achieve.
"When we were young," she said, and Stephen smiled, "Edward and I used still to put the bat among the primates, but now we do not."
"I am sure you are right," said Stephen. "They are very amiable creatures, yet it appears to me that their next of kin are the insectivores."
"Just so," cried she. "You have but to look at their teeth and their hyoids, whatever Linnaeus may say. The primates are much more interesting. Shall we look at them first? The drawers over there and the tall cupboard are all primates. Suppose we were to start with the lowest of the order and work up to the pongo. Here," opening the bottom drawer, "is a common potto, Peridicticus potto."
"Ah," said Stephen, delicately taking up the skeletal hand, "how I have longed to see these phalanges.
Do you happen to know whether in life this aborted index finger had a nail?"
"He had none, poor dear. He seemed quite conscious of it. I often saw him gazing at his hand, looking puzzled."
"He lived with you, sir?"
"Yes, for nearly 18 months, and how I wish he were living yet. One grows absurdly attached to a potto."
Stephen examined the bones in silence for some considerable time, particularly the very curious anterior dorsal vertebrae, and at last he said, "Dear Mrs. Wood, may I ask you to be very kind to me?"
"Dear Dr. Maturin," she replied, blushing, "you may ask me anything you like."
"I too am absurdly attached to a potto," he said, "a tailless potto from old Calabar."
"An awantibo," she cried, recovering from her surprise.
Stephen bowed. "She has been grievously on my mind since we left those parts. I cannot in conscience take her north of the tropic line. I have not the resolution to kill and anatomize her. To abandon her to a local tree in unknown surroundings would go against my heart."
"Oh, how well I understand you," she said, taking his hand in the kindest manner. "Leave her with me, and I will look after her with the utmost care, for her sake and for yours. And if she dies as my dear Potto died, you too shall have her bones."
Friday's market was more than usually crowded, and Stephen's anxiety to find Humusius was more than usually keen. The Harmerton had cracked not only the Commodore's sea chest, but a large number of other things aboard the Bellona, including the caddy in which Stephen kept his small remaining store of coca leaves. The omnivorous, insatiable guinea cockroaches had swarmed in, fouling what little they could not eat, and already he was feeling the lack. But there were large numbers of sailors and marines wandering vaguely about, and a large number, a tribe, of tall, stout, very black men from some region where it was usual to carry broad-bladed spears and a shining trident stood at gaze, amazed by their first visit to a town. Square heaved them gently aside with his shoulder, opening a path as through a drove of oxen. Stephen followed him, and there at last, beyond a snake charmer, he saw the familiar canopied stall, the dreadful great bald dog, and Humusius. Socrates was already present, so Humusius left him in charge and carried Stephen back to the house at once. At their first greeting he said that he had received the Brazilian leaves, but it was not until the door was closed behind them that he spoke of 3 messages that had arrived for Dr. Maturin. Stephen thanked him cordially for his trouble, paid for the leaves, put the messages in his pocket, and said,
"You have been very kind to me. Allow me to suggest the purchase of East India stock as soon as it drops below 116.
They parted on excellent terms, and Stephen, with Square carrying the little sack, set off for the Strand, the boat, the ship, and the privacy of his cabin and his decoding book. But they had not gone a furlong before the road was blocked by a turbulent mass of seamen, many already drunk, all fighting or about to fight, or bawling encouragement of those who were engaged, hands from the Thames and the Stately having a dust-up. Happily a group of moderately sober Bellonas came by, some of them Stephen's old shipmates, and they, forming close about the pair and roaring, "Make a line there!" ran them briskly through unharmed. Once aboard, Stephen hurried below, locked the door, and opened the messages in the order of their sending. They were all, of course, from Blaine's office. The code was so familiar that he could almost have done without the key, and the first 2 were comforting, though unremarkable. The French plan was following its course. There had been 2 unimportant changes of command in minor vessels, and 1 ship substituted for another of equal force.
The third, however, stated that a requisition in the Netherlands had provided faster, better, more efficient transports, and that the whole operation might be advanced by a week or 10 days, and that a third line-of-battleship, the César 74, coming from America, might join the French squadron in 42 degrees 20 minutes north, 18 degrees 30 west. There might, however, be a reduction in the number of French frigates. The message ended with a hope that this might not reach Stephen too late, and it enclosed a fourth sheet written by Blaine himself according to the formula they used for private, personal communication. Stephen recognized the hand. He recognized the shape of the sequences, but he could not make the message out at all, though he was almost certain that one group was the combination Sir Joseph used for Diana's name. He ran clean through the book, a book that he knew backwards in any case, but there was no evident solution. He put the personal message aside for further study and went in search of Jack, who was in the master's day cabin with Tom, all three gazing very anxiously at the chronometers, which no longer agreed, Harmattan, drought and dust having presumably deranged one or both. In some ways, Jack was very quick. One glance at Stephen's face and he was in the great cabin in a moment. He listened in silence and then said,
"Thank God we heard in time. I shall get underway as soon as possible. Pray see to your medical stores at once."
He summoned Tom.
"Tom, we must be underway in 12 hours on the first of the ebb. We are short-handed, and with so many men ashore, hard to find and bring off, we shall be in real difficulties. Send the boats to the last-come merchantmen and press all you can. Stores are fairly good, apart from the gunners, but watering will take place at once. No liberty, of course. Throw out one signal for all captains, and another for the powder hoys. All marines to round up stragglers, and I shall ask the governor to use his troops."
Stephen and his assistants and the Potto in her darkened cage went ashore through intense activity. While his young men did all that was needed at the apothecary's, Stephen hurried to Mrs. Wood with his charge and took his leave, his forced, unwilling leave, as he observed, strangely moved. No young woman could have been kinder. Back on board he saw the powder hoys cast off, and in the waist the resigned merchant sailors being assigned to their watch and station. Within 11.5 hours of Jack's emphatic order, the Blue Peter broke out at the foretopmast head. One or two boats and some frantic canoes came racing through the moderate surf, and at the 12th hour the squadron stood out to sea in a perfect line, steering west-northwest with a full topsail breeze just abaft the beam, and the band of the Aurora playing loud and clear, "Come cheer up, my lads, 'tis the glory we steer, to add something new to this wonderful year. To honour we call you, not press you like slaves, for who are so free as we sons of the waves?"